I'm Mike McGinnis.
And I'm Jeff Prescott.
And you're listening to Open... This is not Open Apple. This is the... That's the podcast I was just doing this morning. This is No Quarter, a weekly-ish podcast about arcade games that we like, love, and sometimes really, really dislike. And how are you, Jeff?
I'm doing very well, Mr. McGinnis. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Doing okay. How was your arcade experience this week?
I was pleasantly surprised and quasi-delighted by this previously unknown video game.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy, right? So
yeah.
Before we, I guess we'll just get right into this. This week we're talking about The Legend of Mikai. I assume that's how that's pronounced. It's a 1988 arcade game by Jalico. I'll also assume that's how that's pronounced. And this is not one I had heard of before, and I'm shocked because I love this game. It's great. What were your initial impressions, Jeff?
In the first 5 minutes, when I coined up and started playing it, I was kind of nonplussed. And it grew on me really quickly, though, as I was able to kind of figure out the weird jumping mechanic. Because you kind of hop and bounce, and you can move while you're in midair, and usually the physics of jumping is, you know, however fast you are terrestrially when you leave the ground kind of affects your flight. And here you actually can change directions, you know, in space. And once I got accustomed to that, and I let it in, it came kind of rushing in, actually. I thought it was kind of beautifully scripted and real lush-looking environments and neat enemies and cool music.
So when you coin up, as you say, and you start, at least my impression first was like the music and the sound effects at first seem kind of, you know, a little plink, plink, plinky, and it has that that weird, I guess it's sort of an electronic organ sound that you hear a lot in creepy games and movies that give it sort of a gothic feel. But surprisingly, that grew on me. And I fell in love pretty quickly. This is a shock for me. You know, we get some great game recommendations, and we get some not so great game recommendations from the listeners. And usually they're ones I've either heard of before, if they're really good or bad, or if they're titles that I haven't played or heard of, or at least read about somewhere, it's because they're forgettable, or, you know, they were only on the market for a month because of a lawsuit or something like that. So I'm sort of surprised that I hadn't heard of this one before because of how good it is and because it's not a fighting game.
It's something more, like maybe greater than the sum of its parts. You can definitely discern certain influences like Rastan and maybe a little Ghosts and Goblins and Rygar kind of elements in the game, but nothing so overt as to turn you off to think that it's a, you know, derivative. It kind of celebrates the little like adventure sequence, run through the forest and collect the gems kind of genre, and it does it really well.
Yeah, it almost feels maybe that they were going for a little bit retro, because this game was released in 1988, which surprised me when I saw how late it was released. And then I'll go ahead and go through the hardware here now because it's sort of appropriate to the conversation. So this was a it features a Motorola 68000 at 6 megahertz. The sound chip is a Zilog Z80 at 3 megahertz, and there's a YM2203 at 1.5 megahertz. And it's 256 by 224 pixels, 768 color palette. And it's an 8-way joystick with 2 buttons, one for jump, one for attack. And given all of that hardware, when you're playing the game, it, at least at first, it feels like it's way overpowered and that you're playing a game from 1982. But once you start getting into how deep this game really is, it begins to make sense because there's so much going on the screen at any given time, and it never slows down. The music and the sound never skip or get crackly or anything like that. And there's so much to explore here that, okay, now that begins to make sense. So the story behind this game is that the princess of the Malakai Wastelands has been kidnapped. I think I've been calling it Malakai, but sorry about that. It's the Legend of Malakai. The princess of the Malakai Wastelands has been kidnapped by an evil undead wizard. There is but a single spell that can defeat the evil wizard. The letters that make up the spell must be found scattered throughout the Malakai Wastelands in order for the evil wizard to be defeated for good. I like that little word play there at the end.
And it's a really neat element that they brought to the game too, because to find those letters in each of the stages, you have to explore. It kind of forces you to like dig around in the little corners and not just attack and go right and, you know, get to the end of the level and proceed and fight boss repeat. It kind of forces you to view the game and to explore its depths a little bit in greater detail, and you're rewarded by that because it's pretty neat.
There's definitely a lot of depth to this game that you don't initially see. You know, when we both had that initial impression of, well, gee, this looks kind of dumb to start off with. But because it feels like a sword-swinging, fight-and-go-right platform jumper kind of a thing that's jumping all over the place. And but you quickly find out that this is actually an RPG. As you're making your way through the forest and you're jumping up and down branches, there are these doors in the trees, and you go in the doors, and sometimes it's a shop, and you can buy, you collect gems and treasure as you're making your way, as you're battling your way through the game, and you can spend the gems on upgraded weapons, and the shopkeepers will sometimes give you hints on where to find keys to certain other areas, and there are treasure chests, and you don't always know what's behind a door. Sometimes when you open the door, you end up fighting a boss. And there's a whole lot more to it, because when you're this little purple and flesh colored, I think that's an elf maybe is what they were going for there. And he's just sort of holding his sword out in front of him. And he doesn't move the sword, and to kill stuff, you just run forward. You touch them with the sword. There's not swinging. And the attack button is actually for your ranged weapons. You get throwing axes and things like that later on. And it feels, so initially the technology feels sort of incongruous and maybe anachronistic a little bit. But it felt more, a lot more like maybe a little bit of Zelda, like you said, and the Mario Brothers level jumping and things like that, or Super Mario level jumping and that sort of thing. And it is a typical rescue the princess mechanic, but you never feel like you're playing a different game. This is, you never feel like this has been a ripoff of another title.
Right. And there is a clock. You don't have unlimited time, like about 3 minutes, I think. And they look like virtual seconds. It doesn't appear to be a fast clock. But I never felt like rushed or squished for time to complete a level. They're not so vast that you can't explore everything and avoid getting killed and fight the boss and succeed. But if you dilly-dally and, you know, intentionally try and string out your quarter, I guess you would be punished for that. Were you ever ripped off by a shopkeeper? Because I was.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. You know what? It didn't actually bother me that much, because I was playing it. I just thought, I'm sure that, like, if I continue to play this game, which I absolutely will after this podcast, that'll begin to bother me. But I was just so enchanted by how cool it was that they would have not just a shopkeeper where you could buy something, but that they would think to have dishonest shopkeepers in there that would rip you off sometimes. And there's a lot more thought that went into this game, I think, than is immediately apparent when you first start playing Legend of Malakai.
Yeah, if you peel back the layers, you'll be pleasantly surprised. The tantalizing item for me was like Potion of Life, and it was like, yeah, 80, I don't know what the currency is. It was gems, I guess. But like, it was just 80 gems, and I'm like, wow, that probably restores, because it looks like you have basically 3 hits and 3 lives. So 9 total hits per quarter. It's pretty easy to avoid being hit through the forest, and then the areas kind of turn a lot murkier. But I didn't have too much trouble navigating the first 2 levels. I never did make it through Area 4, though, and I was really entranced with the waterfall effects and the sounds of the falling water. particularly in the one waterfall stage where you're just, it's cascading behind you, and it's really neat.
Yeah, the sound effects, I think, are they're subtle, you know, and they're definitely not overstated. Some games try to, like, the, you know, when we played Metal Slug X, there's so much sound and it's so loud and there's explosions everywhere, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's great for the game, especially for a game like that, but it's wonderful to occasionally run into a game like this where everything is understated and yet it all comes together to provide this really deep role-playing game experience. You have inventory, you know, that you can keep track of, and the environments that you fight your way through never felt repetitive. You know, from one area to the next, you go from this forest to an area with waterfalls and on through the game. And it was just, it kept this all came together very well for me to draw me in and make me keep wanting to play. I played a lot of this game this week.
Me too. And another really neat element that I encountered in my own frailty, if you come up against a section of an area and you just can't quite navigate it. For the example here, I was in the weird hall where the snaking heads chase you around yes. From platform to platform. And there's one part where I was cornered and I couldn't proceed. You know, they're just brick walls. And I got killed like two or three times in a row. And when I continued on my next virtual quarter, the game had bumped me up and moved me past that obstacle, and I was allowed to continue to the end of the level and fight the boss. And I thought, you know, gee, that's really kind of odd, but I'll take it. It did that one other occasion during the game too, and it really the game would have been contentious and a source of frustration for me to, you know, continually come up against something and just get slaughtered, and I probably would walk away from it. But this was a nice little teaser and a really well-implemented adjunct way to keep you in front of that computer screen and dropping quarters in the game. If I looked at it in the context of, you know, spending money on the game, I thought it was a brilliant little addition.
We played games where they'll skip you forward sometimes, and it feels like you're getting ripped off a little bit because you're missing part of the game, or that it makes... You know, if you can just beat challenges basically by dying, dropping a quarter, moving forward, you know, that's sort of a cheap way to allow you to advance in the game. But this, and we've had that in the past with some of the games that we've talked about, but this didn't feel like that. This game felt a lot more about exploration and finding every nook and cranny and going into every cave, you know, and the shopkeeper said the red key was in a deep cave. So trying to find that and finding your way to the bottom to get the red key felt more important than, oh, I got to beat every single boss, you know. And there is that mechanic where as you advance from area to area, there's a boss fight at the end, which is kind of a well-worn, overused trope at this point. And even in 1988, that was kind of tired. But overall, it didn't distract from the game that sometimes if you were in an area or an obstacle that was too difficult, you could move past that.
And the bosses were all so stylized and imbued with so much personality that I wasn't annoyed by it. It was almost kind of Castlevania-y, you know, when you approach the end of Here Comes the Big Boss. And, you know, like the giant skeleton at the end of the Forest of Bones, and, you know, the wizard himself, or, you know, the weird snaking heads creature, like everything was so neat and unique that I was kind of delighted by the creature detail, and it really didn't distract me and make me think of how cliche, you know, that setup is.
The game we played last week, which was so forgettable, I can't even remember.
Horizon.
That's right, Horizon. You made the comment that the avatar that you were given to represent you in that world was so boring and bland that it didn't really, there wasn't an outlet for the game to draw you in and make you feel like you were a part of it and want to keep playing. Whereas this one, you know, your little pink elf is running around, and it really has, everything in this has personality. The shopkeepers are all different. You know, you're not seeing the same graphic of the same shopkeeper in every one of these. And Yeah, when you're in a certain area, you'll be attacked by, they had like the first area, for example, had those like pink Venus flytrap plants that shot fireballs at you, and those were all the same. But overall, because they don't appear much later on in the game, it doesn't feel like boring and repetitious, and everything has a personality, and yet it all seemed to gel really well with all the other pieces, even though they were all really unique. Those floating face things, you know, were both vexing and fascinating because they're such a pain in the butt, but it's such a neat thing to see in a game that you just didn't see a lot back then.
Yeah, they've cobbled this game together from so many archetypes. Dark forests, enchanting graveyards, underground caverns, richly decorated, decadent-looking castles,
Secret keys.
secret keys, the bone forest. It's so macabre and yet cute at the same time. I mean, there's trees that are composed of femurs and arm bones, and the entire terrain is just the skulls. It looks like, the catacombs in Paris or something. It's really neat. And the keys are, you're rewarded for hunting down those keys and getting and opening those chests because they have the most gems in them. You realize that that's a component you really can't ignore if you want to go further in the game, because you'll get the 300 or 400 or 600 gems necessary to buy that, flying triple axe that will make mincemeat of the boss. And you learn these things very quickly. It all comes together without a convoluted instruction manual. You don't have to be beat over the head. There aren't any secret BS, secret button mashing combination things to learn. It all develops very well and intuitively and beautifully on its own.
Agreed, totally agreed. And I like the fact that in addition to upgrading your sword and your weapons, you also had the option to upgrade your armor, so you could find improved boots and things like that. And that would actually, I think, I can't remember off the top of my head how that worked to protect you more, but I think it bought you like a couple of extra hits or something like that. But I just like how deeply they went into pulling all of these pieces together, which, like you said, were borrowed from all these other things, and yet when they come together in this game, they do so in such a well done way, and it's all so cohesive that it stands alone and doesn't just feel like I'm playing pieces of this game, now I'm playing a piece of that game, you know. And they did have a couple of unique mechanics as well. Like, for example, because it's a jump game, and there's a section where that you have these like flying bat demon things that are coming at you as you're making your way through a forest, but you can actually jump onto those from the top, and automatic contact with your enemy doesn't mean automatic death. You can jump on that, and if you do it right, as it's kind of flying in its little arc there, it can bounce you up further than you could have jumped if you had not done that.
Yes, and learning to hop on top of enemies' skulls and noggins is a really important play mechanic.
Yes.
Just like you said, that can propel you to levels that you might otherwise need one of those little green jumping potions that make your boots glow so you can also jump higher. But that costs 80 gems, and instead of, use this, tweak to the play to exploit, the system itself to get you higher and further. There's a lot of depth, and it's a really neat game.
And on the other hand, you never felt bogged down by the role-playing elements. You know, there was not this, like, I got to spend 20 minutes rearranging inventory and moving stuff around and putting this on and trying that weapon on, that a lot of true role-playing games, sometimes you get that later on. So you have those elements of role-playing and making it feel like you're sort of deciding how the game goes, even though technically it's a game on rails where, you start it, it's you're going to the right and you start at this area, and at the end you have a boss fight, and then you go to the next area, and it's always the same. But you can decide kind of what that looks like. And I guess by owning the game experience a little bit, it makes it something that I keep wanting to come back to and playing again and again.
Me too. It's very cleverly disguised, and it's addictive. It encourages you to hit repeat. You want to continue, and you want to see how you're rewarded with the interesting, the next area, quote unquote. And it, where they're going to go with it. I mean, the most boring part of the game, I thought, were the underground caverns, just because they weren't pushing a lot of pixels and there wasn't a lot of personality in the cave. But the cave itself was a little challenging because there were the elements of, there's those three doors midway through the level, and you have to navigate them correctly to get to the unicorn to get a letter.
Right.
For the spell, and then you have to reverse navigate those doors correctly to get yourself back to a position to finish the level. And that just drew me in. Even on the most simplistic and basic looking aspect of the game, it was fun and felt original.
Yeah, so it's definitely a hack and slash game at its core, but the fact that there are puzzles, like real puzzles to be solved, and ones that make sense in the context of the game, not just random, like, push this button, which button do you push, with no context thrown in, but in fact you're having to navigate your way through doors that make sense because it's been set up that the trees have doors in them, and then behind the doors are certain things that you need, and so this is part of that mechanic. All really felt cleverly implemented, well thought out, and just a blast to play this.
And it never felt like Gauntlet, where you're just kind of trapped and you're up against these generators that just keep churning out enemy after enemy after enemy, and they're all carbon copies, and it's literally, you can just feel the quarters getting sucked out of you. It was much more rewarding than that, you know. I mean, granted, it's a one-player game, and the four-player Gauntlet experience is a totally different conversation, but as a single-player, quarter-munching, adventure, tropey kind of game, it did it really well.
The thing about Gauntlet, and Gauntlet's great, I love Gauntlet, don't get me wrong, even the single-player experience, but there's always that inevitability feeling where, you know, you're going to be overwhelmed, you're going to die, and you're going to have to drop more quarters in it. There's never any doubt going into Gauntlet that you're going to be able to finish Gauntlet on one quarter. It's just not going to happen, but, you know. And that's okay. You accept that as part of the game experience, and it's fun. But with this felt like, I guess maybe the word would be balanced, much more of a balanced system. Yeah, you run into the enemy and you only have to hit them once and the enemy dies, but you don't have a lot of hits either. And so it pays to think about how you're playing, whereas with Gauntlet, you just run in and start swinging or shooting or casting spells until there are too many of them, and then you die and drop a quarter and continue. Where this one, how you play and what you buy, and, you know, whether you want to use, you know, like that jumping on the enemies mechanic, for example, can really affect how the game goes for you as far as how easy it is to advance and what you want that to feel like. It can be sort of a stealthy jumping thing where you just jump over these things and keep going, or you can, you know, hack and slash your way through it too. So it's for a game that's really on rails like that, it has a nice open-ended feel to it, and you kind of get to decide how you want the experience to be.
And even though it's a quest game and there's a pure objective, and that in itself is very hackneyed and cliche, rescue the princess, they've added that neat element of, once you get to the final level, and I only know this because I watched it on YouTube, once you are confronted with the evil, undead, unnamed wizard, and I was really sad that maybe you had better luck than I did. I wasn't able to find really hardly any information that was produced by Jaleco about its title. So I wish I knew what the amazing names of these characters must be, but I only have genericized terms. So undead wizard. Once you confront him, you have to know that spell. The letters have to be spelled out, and you're given a little alphabet sequence, and you enter them correctly. And then he changes from his human form to some demonic-type beast that you then fight and attempt to destroy. And I thought that was just a cherry on the sundae. It was really neat to see that.
Yeah, I think that, again, you know, little stuff like that, the secrets and just all the rich detail in here was seems to have been at least carefully thought out and well implemented. You know, again, when you start out, it doesn't really, you're like, oh, geez, what did I just waste a quarter on? Because, you know, like I said, there's not even a sword swinging animation for your character. You just run up to them and you touch them with the sword.
Yeah, you kind of poke them, right?
Yeah. There's a little bit sexual there, I guess, maybe, but it is a Japanese company, so I guess that doesn't surprise me that much. But at first it feels things that initially feel like, geez, this is, you know, cheesy and a mistake, quickly become charming elements that you just love to see every time it happens. You know, I didn't find a whole lot about this game. I do know that Jaleco is a Japanese company, and this is basically the English version of a game called Makai Denetsu. And maybe there's plenty of Japanese documentation out there, but I don't read kanji, so I don't know. But again, you don't really need it to have a great time with the game. I mean, it's you can jump in easily. I love that you pointed out that you don't need manuals and tutorials and like a practice level and stuff like that. It all makes sense, and yet it's such a deep play experience.
Yeah, the game is designed so well, and it's so well crafted and thought out that the way it presents itself, it's self-explanatory. If you just give it 3 or 4 minutes of your time, you'll get it. And then you'll get something else, and it'll just come together like a puzzle that's an effortless puzzle and a picture you want to see, you know, eventually put together. I'm definitely playing it again.
Some of those games, you know, I have my top 10 or my top 100 top 10 games. Well, I forget the language that we used for that. This is probably, I don't know if it's top 5, but it's definitely top 10, and it may not stay top 10. I don't know that there's a whole lot of replay value once you get through the game, because it definitely has an ending. This is a favorite of mine, and I'm not really big on the sword swinging fantasy genre just in general, because there were so many of those games flooded the arcade market for a while there, and they were all clones of each other. And we've talked about a few of them here on the show, and some have been better than others, but you know, it sometimes you drop that quarter in and you can't even remember which game it is because they're all so similar. And this is a standout for me. I really, really enjoy it. Now, having said all that, Jeff, is there anything about it that you didn't like so much, or you wish they had done differently?
I would only recommend playing this game if you can configure a joystick.
yeah.
Initially trying to play it on the keyboard was kind of nightmarish. Once I was able to map out some buttons on a USB controller, it got easier. The jumping is very unintuitive for me, and it took a long time to code that and hardwire it in my head that you can and need to move and change directions in midair to be successful. And it took a little while for me to embrace and understand and be able to exploit that. But once I got more adroit at it, then I got better at the game. I wasn't ever able to make it past Area 4. I was just overwhelmed at that point. The bosses, those gargoyles seem to be kind of ripe with cheap hits. And the way they flow below the screen point of view and above you, and then kind of loop back and double back and hit you while you're in the air, it has the same unfortunate habit like a Castlevania-type game where you get hit in the air and it changes your direction of flight slightly, and all of a sudden you fall down a hole like in the waterfall levels. That was contentious and frustrating. I'd prefer to just take the hit, shed the hit point, but not change direction to be able to predict where I land. But that's the game world, and it wasn't terrible, but my biggest criticism would be the jumping, and that the enemies seem to have an upper hand, with the amount of territory they can, the bats and gargoyles in particular seem like a cheap hit engine. What did you find, disdainful about it, Mike?
Disdainful is the word. I'm not a fan normally of platform jumpers. It's why I never got into Tomb Raider and games like that. And like you, apparently I had the same difficulty that you did, where it takes some getting used to, and it can be frustrating when you just barely miss something that you were trying to jump to, you know, and you're like, oh, you know, I thought I had it, because a lot of it is understanding and managing that, you know, the arc of inertia where you go up and kind of, and suddenly you're moving down again. And when you add in the fact that you're having to attack things in midair and change direction can be frustrating at first, until you wrap your head around the fact that it's just sort of another play field, if you will, where, you know, that's just another way to do combat. And then it's not quite as frustrating. I found some of the backgrounds were maybe, you know, for as non-repetitive as the game overall felt, the backgrounds kind of weren't the greatest, just because they were sort of all like, you know, a murky brownish in one area and a murky greenish. Now, I did love the waterfalls. That was great. But, you know, if you're running through the castle, it's like slightly yellowish green blocks in front of slightly darker yellowish green smaller bricks in the background. And the trees in the forest are all the same. You know, the branches stick out horizontally in the same fashion all the way around. So I could have used, I think, a little bit more variation there. But that's really all I can think of.
Yeah, not a lot to dislike about it.
Now, did you know about the two different endings that you can have?
I was completely unaware of two different endings. Please inform me. I can tell you the ending I know about, but not the one I was ever able to achieve.
Right. So there's a, and I never got this far either. I only learned about this when I was doing research on the history of the game. There's actually two different endings, which is not something you see a lot in arcade games. So if you enter the spell correctly, you know, part of the whole mechanic is that you're running around collecting these letters that make a word, and you utter this word at the end of the game, and that changes the wizard into something that you can defeat.
Shall we reveal that word?
Please, go right ahead. Spoilers, everybody. Go ahead.
Gixgar?
Yes.
I guess is the pronunciation.
We think, yeah.
G-I-X-G-A-R. That's the one I saw.
And if you enter the spell correctly, you get, you know, the special bonus of like 10 million points it's a bunch of zeros at the end of it. And then you get the screenshot, and it's of this lovely verdant valley, lush with trees and the castle in the background, with a fairy tale castle with a flag flying at the top. And there's a message that says, "Everyone can sleep in peace. Days of peace will last forever."
Thank Did you get an overwhelming that. Princess Bride vibe when you saw that screen?
Yes, I did.
I was. I could just hear "As you wish," like,
right, yeah. Falling down the hill.
Right. Yeah.
But if you enter the spell incorrectly, you get this little graphical sequence where a message pops up. And it shows you kind of bent over and crying, and it says, "Your adventure was failure." I love the English there.
Oh, fantastic. So you're automatically just eliminated.
Yeah. And then the final splash screen is, it's of the same valley, green valley, but it's at night, it's dark, and the castle has a different flag over it, and it says, "The dark despair will go on forever until the end."
Oh my gosh. So the kingdom is like absorbed, like you're the last Sark and you fall on your sword or something.
Well, what happens is you enter it and the guy that you're supposed to kill runs away. And in fact, it says, "It seems to have run away."
Oh, fantastic.
Okay. And then it goes, "The jail door." And then the next screen is, "The princess was already taken away. Your adventure was failure."
So they really, really, really needed the epic fail phrase in 1988, because that's what you were confronted
with. Oh, yeah. It rubs it in your face that you really screwed this up.
And it's just game over, no continue, that's it?
That's it. And then you get taken back to the high screen score.
Now, that...
Or the high score screen, rather.
That is absolutely awesome. I'm blown away. And that just adds even more appreciation for this crazy game for me. I would have been incensed and delighted at the same time by not having I can just see spending $14 to get there and not having the letters. It's not clear to me in the area, since I didn't complete the game, and I don't remember from watching the playthrough, if you get the letters in the right sequence, or if you're just given the letters. Because I got, like, letter I and letter G and a letter A, but I don't know if you need to scramble them all together to come up with a word, and you need to get to the ending multiple times, and it's mix and match. Like, maybe it's, you know, gear gax and fail that and gixgar, and then all of a sudden it works. Is it clear to you, Mike, if they were in sequence, or is it even harder?
I remember them not being in sequence.
Okay, so that makes it even rougher. And that's really devious on behalf of the programmers. Great job, Jaleco.
Well, what I'm reading here, and I've got this review in front of me.
And you think the magic word would have been Jaleco or something stupid right. like that. Or yeah. play again. Or right. So, drink your Ovaltine. What?
Right. I have this review here in front of me that somebody wrote on his webpage, and we'll have the link in the show notes. But apparently there are, you know, when you talk to the shopkeepers, you can get clues to where stuff is, and you get clues as to how, as to the sequence of the letters. So it's not just completely random where you just get lucky one day. You can figure it out, but you have to pay attention to what they're saying to you. And sometimes, you know, it can be easy. You know, I found at first I would just go and buy stuff. And then once I went in there and I realized that there, something else was said to me that I didn't see and had to go back and play through again to see that, oh, I'm getting clues and hints here. Maybe I should pay attention to that.
I wonder how many false flags they issue you too, because they're selling you bogus potions and taking right. your money. I wonder if they're telling you, you know, that the letter Z is really in there and it's not.
Yeah, that's crazy. So this is a very non-linear game, you know, even as far as making your way through the levels, but also even solving the puzzle and how you want to play it. I think this is a wonderful game, and I can't believe that A, I haven't heard of it, and B, I mean, there's, you know, if you do a search for this game, it's not, the information is not as non-existent as it was for last week's game, but there's not a whole lot about it.
I wouldn't have heard anything about this, unfortunately, by 1988. I wasn't setting foot in arcades any longer, but I feel like I've missed out on this experience because there's some real social engineering in play here. I could imagine if you transported this game back 4 or 5 years, hearing kids at school say they knew a friend of a friend that actually defeated the wizard and here was the secret code, and there being a big hubbub about it at lunch on a daily basis and no consensus on what the word actually was. And
well, and those are the same thoughts that I had. I have to wonder about,
you know, like pre-internet, pre-Twitter, when you can't just cheat and Google it up and what is it? Like
right.
that would live almost in video game lore. And it's kind of sad that it's not as appreciated or remembered as it is, that it could be its own meme, but it just doesn't have that much personality or it didn't capture the public imagination that well.
And I have to think that the only thing that occurs to me is that because it came out so late, because it came out in 88 instead of 82 or 83,
yeah,
that's a big part of it. And it sort of feels, we're not really, it's verboten to talk about this game on No Quarter, but I'm going to do it anyway. Oh, sort of feels like a progenitor to Final Fantasy.
No comment. Okay. Right, except that you're not saddled with the whole hit points and static right. fight screens and everything that makes that awful.
Exactly. But as far as having a gameplay with a fantasy role-playing game with depth and action, and sort of cartoonish like fun characters, and because that's the other thing, as far as, you know, the backgrounds, yeah, they're grayish and murky in areas, and they're not that pretty to look like, but the actual the stuff that's going on in the foreground is great visually. It's, you know, like I said, you're dressed in this purple stuff, and the Venus flytraps are this bright pink, and they're shooting these bright red and orange fireballs at you, and everything is very well rendered and colorful, and but not so much that it's clashy or garish and annoying.
Did you see that crazy Japanese, like the Densetsu version, the arcade flyer? Did you find a copy of that? It's hysterical looking.
No, I haven't seen that. No, tell me about it.
Let me pull this picture up so I can wax nostalgic about it. Here it is. All right, so the original Japanese release, there's you, the warrior, looking very Conan-esque, only you have bright blue locks of hair and a gem on your forehead. The princess is hiding and shrouding behind you in a half view. You're holding a giant glowing sword aloft, and it appears that you're both riding the unicorn in the foreground. And in the middle ground is the castle and a bright blue sky and a waterfall and gargoyles jumping through the air and wizards menacing above you. And then the giant evil wizard looms menacingly in the background, hovering over you as a portent, I guess, to here's where all your money's headed. I'll have to forward it to you. It's fantastic looking because it looks like, you know, a ninth grade art student's like fantasy wet dream come to life. It's amazing.
Oh my god. That's hilarious.
It's if I saw this and had to judge the book by its cover on cheesy value alone, I probably would not have approached or played the game. This would have scared me off in terms of how you were indicating its cheesiness and its you know cliched stature as what it is. But having just not seen any of this and approached the game in a raw form, the game speaks for the game, but the advertising is a detriment to the game for right. sure. Marketing definitely messed this one up.
I don't recall ever seeing this game in, well, in fact, I, of course, I don't recall seeing it in an arcade, because if I had, then I would have remembered. I think it's unfortunate because this I think is a real, you know, missed opportunity probably for a lot of gamers. I bet you and I aren't the only ones who are going, what is this game? I've never heard of it.
This is the beauty of discussing these things arbitrarily. I'm now that I know you had no prior knowledge of this and just plucked it from the list, like here we are experiencing something that heretofore didn't know anything about, and I bet the next 20 years I probably wouldn't have hit, you know, play on that title either, but I'm really glad that I've become acquainted with this unappreciated little gem.
And I would imagine that this is going to happen multiple times for you when you do this podcast. That's one of the reasons. Well, it's one of the reasons I keep doing it. And, you know, Carrington and I, and for the short time that Rob was on, he as well, one of the great joys is finding games like this, you know, that I would have played this, even if I knew about it. If I was scrolling through MAME-UI's ROM list someday, this isn't a game I ever would have clicked on to play.
And we can't really be faulted for that. I mean, there's 4,000 titles in that index, and I know I always go back to the same 15, you know, or so, Robotron or Star Castle or whatever,
right.
And keep being frustrated and disappointed and not exploring the avenues deeper. So I'm glad that we do this, because that was rewarding, and it didn't cost anything.
Right. Now, do you know anything about the actual cabinet?
I have questions about that. I did look on the Klov, and there's an entry for the game, and it does indicate there's a unique conversion class, and it calls it an upright. But I know this is a JAMA hardware game, and there's one generic photograph of a cabinet that looks like it's a converted Super Pac-Man that, you know, they painted black and put the marquee on and slapped on a bezel and popped the game into. I couldn't find what looked like a bona fide, unique, original Legend of Mikai cabinet. So I'm suspicious, and I feel that this was only a kit game, and I would support that assertion just because of its 1988 release. I can't imagine that a fringe company late in the game was still, you know, producing plywood unique cabinets and whole games at that point. I would be stunned. But yeah. It might be out there. And I did see a couple of board sets for sale. But that's it.
Yeah, I think you're probably right here. So the quick cabinet description, like you said, this is a JAMA game, and it is based on Jaleco Mega System 1Z hardware, which tells me that that's probably a platform, and they've had games that you could swap in and out, which, you know, would make sense. Then why we're seeing a generic black cabinet with not great artwork. I want to say that it's not, you know, for as wonderful and beautiful as this game is itself, the cabinet, or at least the conversion kit, they didn't really waste a lot of time or effort or money on it.
Yeah, the marquee is terrible looking. I mean, it gives you a...
It's this, like, burnt orange brick wall background, and in front of that, in slightly less burnt orange, is the Legend of Mekai name, and there's a horrible cartoon drawing of a standard Conan-type warrior swinging at that face snake creature boss. And it's all like this murky orange color. And on the actual bezel has like bluish for the lower half, and it's mostly a repeat of the marquee on the above the monitor, and down below it's this completely generic orange and red and yellow horizontal stripes past, you know, and the stick and two buttons. And on the side, you've got, you know, a standard round, it almost looks like one of those vinyl things that you could just slap on the side. It says The Legend of Mekai, and the artwork really isn't related to the game that much at all. So no effort at all put in there. So you definitely, you know, if you have a JAMA cabinet, this is great for that, but you don't need to go looking for a unique cabinet, at least not if your theory is correct that there wasn't a standalone cabinet and it's just an art pack.
You would be remiss. The attention and the details that are imbued in the code of this game are really all you need to focus on. The rest, the trappings are unimportant, and they just detract from a great experience. Like, this is some of the most genericized derivative Conan the Barbarian artwork that you could ever imagine. It does not deserve your dollars. Find the board, plug it into a JAMA cab, and enjoy it the way it was meant to be played.
And short of that, you can definitely play it on MAME. There's no reason that this won't work on MAME. You know, like you said, Jeff, definitely you're going to want to customize your joystick. I had a hard time playing it on the keyboard. Maybe other people are better at jumping games on keyboards. I'm not. But it's, once you do that, it's certainly a playable, pleasurable, and imminently repeatable experience.
I'm one of those guys where I try to imbue physics with herky jerky body motions, and the controller and my wrists need to move to the right to force the character to the right. And that can't be simulated on a keyboard very easily. So it's got to be on a joystick.
Jaleco itself, I'm reading here, is a, this is from the wiki page. It's a, the current incarnation, I guess, is a, was established in 2006. It's a Japanese company, of course. The original Jaleco is now called MCOM, not NCOM, unfortunately.
Yeah, so close to Tron, right? I know, right? I was so excited, and I had to read that two or three times. I'm like, it's the wrong consonant. That would have been epic.
So it's MCOM Holdings, and that was founded in 1974. In 2006, it decided to, the board decided to make it a pure holding company, and it became a Jaleco Holding, and the video game operations were split off into the Jaleco Limited that has existed since then. In 2009, Jaleco Holdings sold that Jaleco Limited to a company called Game Yaru, and subsequently changed its own name again to MCOM. So currently the Jaleco that exists is a wholly owned subsidiary of Game Yaru, and probably has nothing to do with the old arcade business.
And if you're trying, corporate board members of MCOM, to distance your IP and your past history with the arcade you couldn't have picked a worse name to attempt to segregate your company and as a holding entity that's no longer affiliated with entertainment than MCOM. So excellent work.
Good on you.
Yeah, well done. Well done. And did you notice too, Mike? I think Jaleco, I think it's a portmanteau of Japan Leisure Company.
Oh, interesting.
Jaleco. I'm going out on a limb there, but I think that's where that comes from.
That sort of English stuff that goes on over there always fascinates me, because this is a Japanese company, so why would they make a portmanteau of English words?
Yeah.
But they tend to incorporate English into their language in a way that we, at least here in the States, do not do with other languages.
Yeah, it's they fetishize our culture a little too much.
Jaleco, in addition to developing many of their own games, was also a publisher of numerous games. They, for example, R-Type 3, which was developed by IREM, they were the publishers here in the United States. They did the Japanese Super NES version of Jurassic Park. A lot of just weird random stuff like that if you page down through their games.
Yeah, their Base is Loaded franchise for the old Nintendo platforms and all were probably what I best knew them for, and those were decent games. Not as good as Mackay, though.
A lot of, like, Namco, for example, and IREM, they develop games, and the games they develop either simultaneously or they develop them just for the U.S., you know, English-speaking market, you know, and there will also be a Japanese version, or they'll release both at the same time. And it looks like a lot of Jaleco's titles were either Japanese only and there were never any English versions of them, or the English versions came later on. So I think we're focused probably mostly on the Japanese gaming market. Maybe that's why we aren't as familiar with them as we are with, you know, Namco and Konami and companies like that.
Yeah, they're probably much bigger in the homeland than we were ever exposed to. I believe that. And the art department did not share inter-office memos. There's no way. There's no way.
That's hilarious. All right, so it's that time of the week, of course. How did you do, sir?
Well, we agreed previously that questy episodic type games that we would hit multiple credits on, that we'd kind of track that.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. I did that in addition to a single credit. I did not do so hot. My individual credit summation, 16,200 points. And that's dying without completing the first area. On repeat credits, I got trapped and never got through Area 4, not for lack of trying or desire, but I kind of ran out of time. I exhausted 19 credits, $4.75 virtual cents, for a 4,302,800 point total.
Okay.
How'd you do?
I did much better than that. I could generally get to the fourth area on a single credit.
Nice.
I was never able to get through it. It wasn't that I ran out of time. I just got overwhelmed with the enemy. For some reason, the difficulty really ramps up there in that fourth level. I imagine that, because like I said, I'm going to continue playing this game quite a bit, that I'll figure it out. But man, it just... There's some parts in there where it's so difficult that it feels like I don't know how to get past this, but I'm looking forward to trying. So my single credit score was 396,400 points, and I forgot to record the credit drop playthrough to the end. I did play through, and I got the right answer without cheating. Although, like, if you search for Legend of Mackay, you're going to get the Gix Guard or whatever it is. You don't have to figure it out, but I managed to put that together myself and didn't find out about the bad end. Yeah.
Nice.
And that was just from the hints that I got from the shopkeepers and stuff. But I didn't actually know about the bad ending, and I kind of wish that I had got it wrong, because that's kind of cool. I want to see that. So I'm gonna play through again and try and do the bad ending and see what that's like as well, because that just seems so awesome.
Yeah, I that's stunning that you inverted those outcomes, but that's rad. Well done, yeah. Sir. Well done.
Well, and it was, again, with a bunch of quarter drops and stuff. So it wasn't like I did it. It wasn't a perfect playthrough. It wasn't on one quarter. So.
Oh, it was a speed run. You know it. You're putting the feet up right now.
The whole thing done in 11 and a half minutes. No.
Right.
All right. So, Jeff, what are we playing next week?
I'm going to have to change my passwords, too, because I was using Gixgar for years, and that's just irony.
Oh, no.
Next week, our game will sound like this.
All right. Well, once again, thank you, Jeff, for joining me on the podcast, and for everyone at home playing along and listening. You can find us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/noquarterpodcast. We're on Twitter. It's at No Quarter Show, because No Quarter Podcast was one letter too long, so that would have been No Quarter Podcasts, which was just weird. So, but if you and there's a community of us that like to talk about these games, and of course you can troll us with your awful game selections if you like, and we'll play them, and you can hear us complain about that.
Yeah, if that's your thing, then we are here for target practice.
See you next week, everybody.